That's because it's entertaining and intelligent, and given the fact that there are, you know, a bunch of these happening, you know, it's cool that it happened. So that's why Kermit, he's a star. Welcome to the Backpack Show, everybody.
Oof, I'm just waiting for this to get out of your system. It took months for avocado to work its way out.
Weather report in Boston today is there's a snowstorm outside my window. Totally not kidding. Absolutely snowing outdoors. Happy Friday, says Coach Woodard early on. Listen, we have a show today. Carrie was able to get Arthur Lee from LifeVac. I'll tell you why I'm stumbling over LifeVac. I have a friend who's CEO of LifeKey. So the CEO of LifeVac, Arthur Lee, is going to show us an incredible product today. And totally last minute, I begged my friend Karen Eber, who's a storytelling expert, a business storytelling expert, has a TED Talk with over a million views, all about business storytelling and all that. Hey, how crazy are you? And that was like 11 minutes ago.
Just want to paint a picture for y'all. And Chris is like, I begged. It's like he tweeted, hey, will you? And she was like, okay.
I said, how crazy are you? Could you please? You know,
that's not
you know.
Begging. I mean, it's very nice asking.
Please, Karen, please. Would you do it? Please.
I'm saying, I expect better when you want to beg me for something. Like,
oh, yes,
more work.
Chris. I'll work harder at it.
Hi, everyone. Tim Kitzer from NBA Jam and NFL Blitz. Welcoming you to The Backpack Show. Your hosts, Chris Brogan, Kerry Gorgone, Boom Shakalaka.
Backpack Show.
Oh, you just never know. this is a great crowd who showed up today on a Friday.
I love Len Joy so much.
Author Len Joy is here. I see my biological father, Steve Brogan, is here. His wife, Diane, also known as my mom.
Chloe, my very favorite Squarespace website developer.
Oh, my gosh. Hello, amazing. Paul. Janice is here. Yeah.
Bob says, yes, mistress. That That's actually wow. So on Facebook where you can tell people how to pronounce your name, which is a very helpful feature. I put, yes, mistress.
Oh, geez.
Oh, so unhelpful. But you know what? I pay the price. I deal with everybody mispronouncing it all the time. So I feel like I pay, you know, it's a trade-off.
Now, Leslie lives a couple hours up the road. Leslie, I have snow coming down here, like intense snow, like in movies.
If you have, she probably has, because Maine always gets more snow than Massachusetts. Isn't that so?
Usually, but weirdly, where we are right here, the snow goes up. I mean, our weather goes up to where she is. I don't know how that works.
So what first, choking or storytelling? Because some people, when they go to storytell, choke.
Oh, I don't know. Let's grab Arthur. We'll talk a little bit about some choking, and then we're going to talk about storytelling. We got so much to do. You know what I'll do though, really quick? I'll do our ads so that we don't have to get them later, right? So, StreamYard. If someone's here who's never seen me before but saw them, I was all over StreamYard. That's me. That's the app. I'm Chris Brogan from StreamYard now. That's my only accomplishment.
It's really juicy, slick tech. People kept asking me in about August if I would run their shows with them. They wanted me to co-host and stuff. They didn't love me. They just love StreamYard. So
they didn't know that at the time.
They didn't know that. That's what it is. So
what's your secret, StreamYard?
StreamYard.
If you want a .online domain for just $1, cbrogan.me/online. Go in there and stuff the code Chris in there, all caps. And you get it for $1. Hey, want a podcast host? Get one. Casthost.com. It's a little different.
Love the weather updates we're getting now from Southern Maine.
Well, Camp Coders Academy, I'm glad that you're here live. So,
Chip says, welcome. People don't mispronounce my name. They just call me the wrong name. Skip, Chris, Chuck, etc.
I call you Chris. Let's grab Arthur Lee, and then we're going to grab Karen. Karen, that means, by the way, you get like 10 minutes. So if you need to make a potato chips or something.
You need to write up a TED Talk for us.
Deep fry a banana. I don't even know what. So Arthur Lee from LifeVac, welcome on board. How are you?
I'm good, man. Thank you very much for having me on. A little awareness would save a life. So I appreciate it.
Tell us about the story. As a former terrible teenage babysitter, tell me about the invention and how you came to create it.
Well, I was visiting a friend in the hospital. His mom was having something done. I just was hanging out with him, you know, and he pointed over at a gurney and said, hey, the last time I was in this hospital, there was a 7-year-old on that gurney had choked to death on a grape. Aww. And in my life, I had a car accident. A friend died right in front of me. And my daughter was 7. And I was like, well, you know, didn't they do protocol? Didn't they do abdominal thrust? And he said, well, they said it didn't work. And he went through the the feelings, the sounds of the parents wailing, and it all just brought up a lot of emotion. And I said, gosh, I took the course when my daughter was born, and I learned what to do. I didn't know it didn't always work. So I went home and I looked for something that I could buy, and I didn't see anything but these objects that had these big tubes and you could stick them in. And I said, man, I'm going to be pretty scared. So I need something simple. So I set out to come up with something very simple that I felt comfortable using. And when I got it perfected for her, I just felt obligated to bring it to everyone else. You know, it's a very common tragedy, and I've been blessed.
And it's avoidable.
Save a lot of kids and a lot of people.
And you don't intubate. That's scary to me too. Like the things you're saying about when they want to like shove tubes down there, it's scary.
Yeah. So
this is none of that.
No, it's a little sink plunger, you know, and you push it, air vents out, you pull it, it creates a suction, and it's just that noise pops it out of your throat. And you know, we've had parents save their children, you know, and the ease of use. And yeah, I've been even lucky enough to meet some of the kids, and I can't come up with a more rewarding moment than when I meet the children that are saved and still here because I took a sink plunger and made a life-saving device.
Wow.
It's pretty intense work. I have to know, like, what were you doing beforehand? I mean, before you started running a life-saving company, were you like, I don't know, mowing lawns or something? Like, where do inventors come from?
You're not really far off. And it's kind of a life challenge. I had built up with a partner a shipping company. I drove a truck in college, and I wound up working my way through the process and owning my own company. And I had sold it, and I planned to retire. I liked to build. I was going to make boats, and I was going to make tree houses. I was going to play golf. And, I felt obligated that I had to do it. Trust me, I didn't want to because it's brutally hard. I don't recommend trying to make a medical device out of your garage. It's a daunting process, but it's just different than my first time. My first time I worked for a job, I had to make money. And this time I was saving lives, so I had to do it.
So it's intense. I mean, that's inventors always come from strange places. The ones that we end up knowing about. There are people that spend their whole life inventing things that nobody uses, and then you come along and this is a life-saving, world-changing kind of experience that you've had to put together. And I always need to know that. So that's cool about the shipping business. And I'm curious to know, are you going to now make some boats, or are we going to stick running this company for a while? Like, what do you do from here now that you've made it? Now you've worked all these years on the approvals and all the stuff it takes. What do you do next, business-wise?
It's a good question. It's a decade, but through this process, people in wheelchairs often have no rescue option. You can't get your arms around them to provide an abdominal thrust. And I've been blessed to spend a lot of time in cerebral palsy facilities and whatnot. And I purchased a boat that has a landing ramp, so you can put people in wheelchairs. So this is my first, I started last summer, but my goal is to take people in wheelchairs for boat rides on the Great South Bay. So, I the joy that I've gotten from the few people I took out last year, so that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to ride people around on the bay in a boat that has a landing ramp. It's actually a fire boat. So that's me.
Wow. Did you refurb that boat yourself?
It's actually a fire boat because not a lot of boats have a landing ramp.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so I'm going to leave it that way. I think that the kids like it. It's cool, so I'll whiz them around the bay.
Okay.
My goal is to have them all over the place eventually.
I love it. Well, Elizabeth has a question. Carrie?
How long did it take to approve a medical device like this?
Well, the process works in the United States and other places. We're all over the world. We've saved lives all over the world. FDA is classified class 1, class 2, class 3. As a suction device, we're class 2, no PMA, no 510K. So basically, it's a registration process, but you then get audited, which is a very intense process.
And they're like, does it suck? Yes, it does.
Yeah. I got to tell you, that the audit sucks worse than the white guy. But, you know, we do, in a way, it made me very comfortable with the process, that the products that do come out are very well looked at, you know. So the timing is, it's not really a lot of time. If you have to get approved, it's a humongous process, but because it's simple and can't hurt you, it's a class 2, no PMA, no 510.
So Paul thinks you should be the world president.
Oh, thanks, Paul. I don't want to do that.
I don't blame you.
It's too messed up.
It's, yeah. It's saving just a few people's breathing is one. You know, if you invented the opposite and stopped some breathing, you know, you could also
change the world.
So the whole idea of those boats and making people smile is just stuck in my head. I apologize, but I'll get back to saving the world. 10 years, Arthur.
Yeah.
It's 10 years. How many times did Lee say, this is crazy, stop it?
Well, when I first started, I got a lot of, don't do it, you'll get sued. You have a good life, you can't, you know, why risk it? You'll get sued. Everyone tell me I get sued. But I said, well, we cannot as a world not persevere to save children's lives because we're afraid of getting sued. So that was the number one, beat me down to death. The second one was, the biggest challenge was, you can't test it, right? I can't bring in people and say, hey, do me a favor, choke, I'm going to see if this thing will pull it out. So being an air freight guy, I moved boxes for a living. I had to learn all this, and we processed through a test that we could do. We did dummies, we did cadavers, and then we had, we now have 4 peer-reviewed medical journals. And before this, I didn't know what a peer-reviewed medical journal was, but it was the saving of a child. There's a story about me praying and the shooting star going by, and I knew that I had to keep going. That was pretty much the deal, you know. Once he told me I had to do it, I did it.
Well, I think a lot of people would think, why do we need a device? We have the Heimlich maneuver. But the Heimlich maneuver, maybe you have a 50 to 70% chance of survival, right? This is, with the LifeVac, a 99% chance.
Yeah, and we're survival. Fortunate that it's really 50 to, by the American Heart Association, it's 50 to 85. But the problem is the 50% is that it happens, right? And someone's there, someone's not there. And that's if a professional can get there. But the problem people don't realize is you only got a few minutes. You have no air. It's like being at the bottom of a pool, you know? So it's really a 50-50 chance. If someone in your arena chokes and it doesn't work, they tend to die. And when I knew that, and I knew it was one child every 5 days, I had to do something, you know. I couldn't imagine just holding her and saying, oh, golly gee, it didn't work, you know. And so I tried to keep it inexpensive. It lasts forever. It covers a whole family. I did it as morally as I could, which the business world doesn't like, which makes it harder. But I don't care. I'll do it right. And we've saved over 50 kids. So I'm going to do it.
Coach, it's for adults as well.
Yeah, I made the kit for both because,
we all choke
individually and make more money, but then you're a jerk.
Thank you. So few people get that, it seems like.
Right.
Like when they broke the last two Harry Potter movies up. Jerks.
Same thing. The price is so reasonable. Like when I looked at it, it sounds like an awful infomercial, but I promise it's absolutely not. But I was thinking about, it's $70 to throw one of these in your cars. It's got an adult and a kid thing in it. It's got the little instruction card. It's got the little plastic. You know where to find it because it's bright yellow. Why would you not put that in your car? House for sure, but you never know where you're going to be out somewhere and you're going to need that. I think it's just crazy not to use it. So 122 lives saved.
We had a woman out in California save her child, and she'd been traveling, and she had packed her home kit with her traveling, and she came home, and she almost couldn't find it. And that's when the travel kit came out, and the backpack show, it's funny, and it's cool. That's what I put in my backpack when I travel.
There you go.
The because I couldn't imagine being on an airplane and someone chokes to death. I'm like, sorry, I forgot to have it today. So that's what I put in my backpack.
So Bob Collins was actually just asking, how can we get these in more schools and kids' sporting associations?
You know, I so appreciate that. My real passion is schools and special needs and elder care. That's where I kind of feel it has to be. It's America. You're a parent. You know, make your decision. That's fine. But we really need to support that. We're in almost 700 schools now. America is a little slow on the elder care side.
What?
We
don't care about the elderly?
I know. It's so brutal. In the UK, we're in over 6,000 elder care homes. We've saved over 30 elderly people.
And seconds matter. Like, moving quickly matters.
Yeah. But the passion is the schools and the special needs. I have to win in special needs because they may not have any option, you know? I almost cursed. That's not right.
This is impressive. It's so incredible. And I'm so grateful. I think if everyone on the show wanted to do something, one thing they could do is start tweeting about it, sharing about it, and see if you can get more people to pay attention that there's a kit like this. I've never heard about it.
Yeah. You know,
why hasn't the world heard about this, Arthur? This is crazy.
Well, like I said, with the price being as it is, there's not a lot of support. It lasts forever. People in the support world want it to expire every year so they can
Right.
spend more. But you know what? I don't care. Me, you, we'll do it together. We just get the word out and we'll win morally correct. So let's do something right for a change.
Actually, you know, Leslie just brought something up that I want to circle back to. Leslie said about the automatic defib units. So those kits, somebody we all know, Carissa, who I'm forgetting her name.
O'Brien Karamanis. Yeah.
Karamanis, thank you. Carissa Karamanis worked with or had something to do with the automatic defib outreach program to try to get more places to have them because of the same kind of reasons about people choking on stuff all the time, people having heart problems and those defib kits not being anywhere to be found. She's saying a lot of what you said, Arthur. It's just really hard. Those kits last forever as well. And they're, to your point, the only medical devices we want to seem to create in this world are ones that we can, you know, that have a razor blade kind of component. You know what I mean? A reuse kind of component. So,
and it took a lot of work. If you hear the rattle, I had to use a ball valve, otherwise it would deteriorate. But Leslie's 100% correct. You know, we have defibrillators, Narcan, and EpiPens, which is great. I'm all into that. The number one cause of accidental death in school is choking. Number one. Every year. Several kids died. 2 weeks ago, kid died in Tennessee. So it's brutally painful that the least expensive thing that lasts forever, requires no maintenance, and has the most deaths is not at the top of the list. But we'll get there, man. We'll keep going.
Arthur Lee, thanks for coming on the show. I very much appreciate it. I had an idea, so I'm going to follow up with you via email after this. Maybe I could do something to connect you with someone that might really like this cause. So thank you so much for being on our show.
Don't go away.
You guys,
yeah, no, stick around. We got more for you.
Okay, I will. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Arthur. And thanks, Lily. I'm just going to call her Lily.
Bob says your core, heart, and earnest approach to this issue is infectious and well appreciated. It's true. Most people, if they could sell separate kits instead of putting a family thing together, they would.
I feel moved, and I have a feeling that in his community, I bet Arthur is known as like a pretty good guy, but I bet everybody doesn't think of him as like some life-saving guy wandering around trying to fix all that. You know, and of course he doesn't want to be like, you know, no one wants to be praised in that crazy way, but
no, he's so right. It's scary. It's scary if you've ever been in the presence of a child choking or somebody else choking. It's scary.
I'm buying one of the kits, by the way. I'm right away.
Put it in the trunk of your car.
It's a mega panic for me. Like it's a mega panic for choking. You know,
I have a niece who has cerebral palsy and epilepsy, and she was really hungry and ate too fast in an IHOP, I want to say. And she was pretty big by then. My sister turned her. She's in a wheelchair, so like Arthur was saying, the Heimlich's really difficult. She's in a wheelchair. Took her out of the wheelchair, turned her upside down, was doing back blows on this kid that was solidly like 12 years old.
Wailing on a kid in an IHOP.
Yeah. So, yeah. And she, you know, saved her and everything. Everything's fine. But it was like...
Yeah, but imagine that's the other way to do this. One is take this device, push it up against the face, go...
And then...
Like a throat plunger, and it comes right out. Or beat the shit out of your kid in front of a whole bunch of people.
Yes,
oh,
exactly.
My gosh.
As one does.
As one does. Nate Bargatze was telling about, like, post-COVID, his mom and dad going to restaurants are going to have trouble because he says, I think my dad's favorite thing to do in the world is choke. Oh, he chokes, like, every day.
Stop it.
So, all right, I'm grabbing Karen. Karen Eber is a professional storyteller. I saw her on TED and was enamored instantly. I was just like, this woman knows what she's talking about. This is insane. We got to talk business storytelling. And today, my infatuation grows. See you, Bob. Good job. Today, my infatuation grows.
To the point where you're actually going to bring her out?
No, she's just for me. Oh, mine. Okay. I begged her, like, with minutes to go, come on the show. She said, okay. Hi, Karen.
Hey. It's worth telling. I was a kid that choked. I was, like, really? One of those kids. I was eating pumpkin pie, racing my sister and how fast I ate it. And as you're racing, you keep taking bigger and bigger pieces. And I took a piece way too big, and it got stuck. And thankfully, my mom knew the hind leg maneuver, and she came behind me, and she got it out. And then I started crying because it was, you know, I'm like 8 years old. It was completely unexpected. And she thought she broke my rib because I'm crying. And it was just more the shock of it all. So I can imagine if she had something just be like, would have been a lot less.
You would have been right back to eating pie.
Right? Yeah. Exactly. I know. It took me a while to eat pumpkin pie after that. But
did you switch to ice cream? Because I would.
Look what Karen just did. I just realized what she did. She connected the story that we just had with Arthur to a pumpkin pie eating contest story. What are we not going to think about? Like, whoosh, Karen, pumpkin pie. Pumpkin pie, not any pie. My sister, I wanted to beat her. Ambition. Like, there's all these storytelling elements. You can't help yourself.
From restoring breath to stories that take your breath away.
It's completely true. I think in stories, I'm continually dropping in random things that I hear. So this is going to be a good test, especially since I had 10 minutes notice, which from what I gather from Carrie, I should have held out more from something from you.
Right?
But let's do it.
Well, you and Chris should duel because he's the king of putting these random things in his stories. So I'm ready for it. Let's go.
Well, who wants to go first? My friends and I will challenge each other with a word or a concept that you have to bake into a story and keep a straight face. You know, like one time it was working the word bucolic or something like that. So nice. we could throw something like that at each other today.
Well, so I was thinking about that because there's a what do they call that? One's like a mountain and one's like a project. And was it Petacucha, something like that?
Do you know Petacucha. Yeah.
So I've always been turned on by that, just like when I was in writing groups way on a million years ago when Yahoo had Yahoo groups. I had this, I was in a writing prompt group, and every single week they'd throw out a writing prompt, and I loved it. Endlessly, I would like to write with the writing prompts. I feel like there's people who just live for that, and there's people who would just faint and die to think about they had to make something on the spot like that.
Karen, I love that. Do you ever do PowerPoint karaoke where they show somebody else's deck and you get up and just they're like, okay, yeah. So this is about blah. Make it up.
That becomes my question to Karen. How do you bring this to a corporation? Because I failed. I tried my hardest in 2020 to sell exactly this business storytelling, and everyone said and filled my diaper. So help me.
Yeah.
So you're saying you choked?
But good job. Good job. Virtual high five on that one. Impressed. So I actually focus on helping companies reimagine how they evolve and shape their culture. And storytelling is a big piece of that because a story is going to communicate what is valued and encouraged or discouraged. It's going to tell you a story of an example of like what great looks like. I had a role before I opened my company. I had a role in General Electric where I was a head of culture in a business of 90,000 employees in 150 countries. And the only way you're going to make any progress in shaping culture is to have each person stop and think, like, what does this mean for me? And what do I want to do? And there's no way one person can touch 90,000 people. So I started using stories as a way to connect. And it was amazing. It didn't matter where people were in the world, their gender, their generation, like the stories connected with them and allowed for them to think, what would I do in this situation? What is helpful? What do I want to do? And so I've, throughout my business career, been using stories like this as a way to help people reflect and set intentions on how they want to respond. Sometimes companies want it. It's the sexy thing. Like, let's talk about storytelling. And sometimes companies realize, you know, we need to work on our culture. We need to develop our leaders. Our team's different. And I work it in that way.
When you were at GE, if a crazy Karen Eber wandered in to try to promote something like this, would you have just shut the door on her face? Or like, how would crazy Karen Eber find her way into a company like a GE?
What most often happens is people are coming because they have seen a TED Talk or they've seen stories or they want to learn more. Or in the course of working with me on culture, I'll drop different stories because it's how people are going to remember and relate. And then they want to learn more and then they want to understand how to do it themselves. And so I like to call it of sneaking in the vegetables. Sometimes I go in with the big culture where we're calling it culture and it's a big initiative, or the big storytelling, this is what we're here to do, or I just sneak it in and then they get the experience of it, which makes people more open to it and trying to do it.
I'm into it.
Well, that's clear. But what if if the story that you need people to remember is the distressing one, kind of like I'm thinking of LifeVac, you know, the story that inspired Arthur to create that device is like fairly traumatic and people don't necessarily like thinking about distressing things. So what do you do? Do you tell the story to focus on, you know, the positive outcomes, or like how do you cast a story like that when your business story starts in a place of fear?
I think the beautiful thing about Arthur's story is you have tragedy that gave birth to this amazing thing that is now generous and life-saving and incredible. And so a story is going to do a couple things. It's going to leave the listener changed. Like neurologically, you were chemically altered after hearing a story, to the fact where it can even be measured on a wearable device right now where they can see where oxytocin is released. So a good story is going to leave you changed. And it's okay if that story's arc goes to a heavy place, because in this case, the story's ending in a place where there's a really important mission that was born out of it and something that's going to be able to change lives. I think it's great to take your audience on that journey and have them feel this. And it already happens, because how many times have you sat in a movie, it's like racing because the character on screen is running through things. Sorry. Yeah.
There's been plenty of movies that I was like, I was ready to punch out about midway through. Yeah.
Or the other one is The Notebook, right? So many people get like verklempt when they find out Noah wrote Ali Letter Day.
Whoa, spoiler alert.
I know. Sorry. a couple of years late. But the stories are taking you on this journey, and actually neurologically your brain starts mirroring the experience as though you're actually having it. So I don't think it's bad to take people's emotions. The key to storytelling in business is you want to be intentional of what do you want your audience to know, think, or do different, and then you bring them on that journey to go there.
The thing I was thinking as you were saying that is that it's sort of where, well, one of the things I learned when I was trying to figure out storytelling in my business and how to kind of execute on that was that if I don't prescribe what I hope people will take from the story, sometimes that causes a challenge. Do you get into that in your process at all?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when I'm working with leaders. So a lot of times I'll work with a CEO that's got like their annual meeting, or they're going through a merger and they want to be able to make a big company-wide announcement, or they want to talk about a new direction. So I've had this where a CEO came to me and he had like a 50-minute presentation. It comes with 50 slides of data. And it's like, put all that aside and let's start over. What is it that you're trying to do? And what do you want people to know and think and do different? And let's use that as the starting point, because there's two experiences of the story. There's the story you tell and what you intend, and there's what the listener experiences, because our brains anticipate and we're going to hear a story and put it in our filing system in our brain of what we already know or experiences we've already had and see what makes sense to us. So what you intend still might be different from what the person experiences or comes away with, but you're going to land much closer to that outcome that you want.
Harry?
I was just thinking about the stories that don't actually come down on one side or another, like the Sopranos type ending. Sorry for that spoiler, where you're not sure what the ultimate conclusion is and just how pissed off people get about things like that. So is that good because they remember it all this time later, Or is it not good because people are ultimately seeking that satisfaction of a resolution?
Yeah. So like the good part about it is a great story is going to build and release tension. So as you're listening to the story, as you're watching the episode of The Sopranos, because your brain loves to anticipate, the good story building tension is going to have your brain not be able to anticipate because it's going to be wondering like, what is she talking about and where is this going? So the good part of the ending of The Sopranos is it was just unexpected and your brain didn't get that resolution and it couldn't fill in the gaps. The bad part is our brains hate things to be incomplete. So we're now writing our own versions of that and grappling with it. Like, what is it, 10 years later at this point?
Yeah, we've seen it like dissected on the internet.
So the attributes of a good story are there because you're right there with it. And, you know, his daughter's trying to park the car and she's taking forever to get in. And who's
whether that song that's playing, whether the ding was in the song or if it's the bell of the door. And like, yeah.
Totally. And all of that is chemically altering you. So the elements of a great story are there where it's building that tension and making you wonder, which is going to make your brain slow down and not anticipate and all of that. But we do hate not having an ending because our brains hate for things to be incomplete.
It's funny. I was thinking about the fact that for whatever reason, business people tend to throw everything out the window that they've learned or even just experienced in non-business settings. So fictional things like watching The Sopranos, however many people went through that series arc experience together, like know what that feels like. And then they put their slide deck together and it has nothing to do with that. It never connects with that. I just did a board of directors presentation slides and the coaching to go with it. And so many of the people who are kind of feeding that board, they thought they were building like a 55 season data episode and not like we need to tell these people a story that ends with the board going, okay, this company's good. I'm glad we invested with them. You know, it's amazing that they don't make that transition. Why don't they? And I guess maybe one last question about that, which would be what are just the first few little seeds we can plant in their little brains?
Yeah, the reason why is, first of all, we just don't leave ourselves enough time. Like we know we've got this presentation and what most people do is they open PowerPoint or Prezi or whatever their tool is and they start looking for all the existing slides they have. I'm like, I could take this one and this one. They start jumbling them together instead of starting with like, who is the audience? What do I want them to know, think or do different? How do I do that? What are some different ideas for storytelling? So the first mistake people make is I'm going to spend 2 hours on my PowerPoint and not spend any time, maybe 5 minutes thinking about what. So this is where when people do use stories because they're told use a story, it bombs because they haven't thought about it or put enough work into it. And so the best thing to do before you open anything is to step back and really think about what you're trying to do in that presentation. Storytelling actually doesn't start with the story. It starts with the audience because it is the specificity. It's the ability to call on things that's going to be familiar to the audience, like The Sopranos or like pumpkin pie or something that is a specific detail that people are going to grab onto because those are the things we're going to identify with and hold our interest more. So first thing is close all your apps and start with the who are you talking to and what are you trying to get them to? And then from there, there's always this question of where do I find ideas for stories? So I love open that you've done a lot of things with writing prompts. Writing prompts are so great because the biggest challenge people have in finding stories is they don't know where to find them because it's just way too wide. The constraints are what help you think of a story. So when I'm working with people, I'm giving them different constraints to think about. If I said, tell me about your childhood, you might come up with something to tell. But if I said, tell me about a sound that reminds you of home, you probably have a really specific story in a specific moment. And so the idea to find ideas for stories is to apply constraints. And it doesn't have to be your own story. I tell stories that are other people's. Don't make them up. That will be the fastest path to people not trusting you. But start with the audience and then apply constraints to get some ideas.
Elizabeth had one comment here. So a good story causes feelings and emotions in our bodies. Live it, human feeling machine, and not as analytical or rational. feel like people forget that.
Yeah, this is the thing, right? Data doesn't change our behavior, our emotions do. And I talk about this a little bit in the TED Talk. Like, we love to think we're making logic, rational decisions. But when you really dig into the neuroscience of decision-making, it happens in your emotional epicenter. And you're making decisions based on what you know and what you've experienced in the past. And most of the time, it happens subconsciously. It's just at the point that it comes up to the conscious level where you become aware of it, you then apply a rationalization. So that's why you know, buy the car because you really love the cup holder, but you tell yourself it's because of the gas mileage.
Yes. Yeah, right. We justify it later using facts and data, but it's emotion that drives us to do it.
Yeah,
totally.
Well, I'm not going to panic that Arthur's screen just went dark gray.
I've got more stories. We can keep going.
Because I was just about to click it. I'm bringing Arthur back. So Arthur and Lily, if you could still hear me, please refresh your screen. And I'm glad you have more stories. With one thing about tying emotion to story and all that and sort of making people feel it, I guess it's worth pointing out that people don't understand that, you know, even when data has to be communicated, there has to be at least some underlying frame of emotion. There has to be some sense of, you know, these numbers mean this, and it can't all just be congratulatory. It just, we don't only want to feel elation. We want to feel that this means the clock is ticking or that sort of a thing.
Yeah. Like, data doesn't speak for itself. How many times do people put up these very tedious small font slides and say the data speaks for itself? Well, it doesn't, because we're all going to fill in the gaps until someone takes us through it in a consistent way. We're all going to anticipate and fill in the gaps of understanding differently. And so the benefit of using a story on data is you are being thoughtful about what is it I want people to know with this? What is it I want them to do? And how am I taking us through this in a way so that people can think about what it means for them?
And it's too much. Let's not do 20 data points on a single slide. Like, one.
That's
for your audience very significant.
Completely. The leader that came with the 50 slides for a 50-minute presentation, we used two. You didn't need all the other stuff. But it's insecurities of, I don't have this fully formed idea, but I know I have to go in front of this group. So I'm just going to throw everything at it because then I look like I've done my homework and I'm really well prepared. When in reality, you're just making everybody like want to pull out their eyelashes one by one and forget about the whole conversation and meeting within 20 minutes after leaving the room.
Back when we could be on airplanes, I used to see people doing PowerPoint presentations on the airplane and they were always adding. And at that point, you need to be taking stuff out. You should for sure not be adding.
Whenever I do keynotes, they're all photos because it's like such a pet peeve when people get up and they say, I'm not going to talk to what's on the slide. Well, then why are you using it? Like, part of our challenge is we should be holding the message and bringing it forward, whether it's a business presentation or a story or anything. And so often we just haven't put enough time into thinking about what we're trying to do. So we let the PowerPoint or the slides drive the discussion, and that helps no one.
Right. You don't know what you're going to say.
You know, something you mentioned about that, and then we got Arthur back in the system. We're alive again. One thing that I'll sort of finish this conversation about is that I got too excited. I was so excited.
I'm
so excited that he got back. No, the thing about school and all that, the feeling like you're making a homework presentation. I feel that all the time. I feel so often that what happens is we get this somewhere in the back of our primal brain or whatever, our secondary brain over the primal brain. We get that feeling that we're trying to pass in a presentation to school. We're like trying to impress a teacher or a professor, which is why we use big words. We use as much data as we could throw. No one wants it. And what we're least doing is thinking, how do I get my point across? That's not what we're asking. So that's not a question, because I'm going to get Arthur before I lose him again. but Karen, you're a wonderful person for coming on so fast like that. Thank you.
My joy.
Let me hit a button. Boop. There's Arthur. Watch me do this because you know I'm going to.
they always have to be in the order that they were in when they came in the green room. Completely just happenstance. They land where they land based on when they arrive. And you have to have them back just exactly as
I absolutely do not really have most people, but boy, do I like to make things go where they belong. Arthur, while you were out, I dropped a line to my pal Craig Newmark, who founded Craigslist back in the day. You might have heard of Craigslist. He does a lot of charitable work and a lot of giving with schools and helping schools drive their fundraisers. So I reached out to him, and we're going to have a conversation in about 30 minutes talking about you and your business. So I may not be making sort of a connection there. Just keep your inbox open for it. But
well, thank you, man. That's amazing. Karen, you well, thank you.
We're amazed. Karen has a story for you, by the way, that you may have missed.
My pumpkin story?
You, well, yes.
Okay. Did you hear the story about me choking on a pumpkin pie?
I did. And, you know, it's interesting that everyone here had a choking story. And the story of that is, it really is that common. And that's why we got a win. And Chris, you're amazing. I appreciate that. I mean, Karen coming on this quick, and what I loved it. I kind of blinked out for a little while, but I enjoyed you so much. This has been an awesome show.
Well, I sure liked it.
Well, Carrie put it together.
Here's a story. I offered to help backstage set people up because I was doing research and putting comments in during these shows when Chris was doing it by himself. And he's like, sure, I would very much like that. And then he pulled me up front the first day and I've been here ever since.
You're going to be a co-host. Okay.
Yeah.
Go for it, right?
Oh, I guess I'll put lipstick on then.
Yeah, Carrie went from sometimes having lipstick near the desk to like
every day. I got everything. Yeah, everything
here. Lipstick.
You only get pulled out in your workout gear once. That's what happens. Once is all you get.
Once is all you get.
Yes.
All right. Yes. We've got three more things to do.
Oh, and here's our person of the day. Kaboom!
This might be tricky. There's some great comments today. There are some great comments today. We always put together a person of the day, which is somebody that we just thought, and by we, I mean me, just thought, hey, that was a nice contribution to this whole thing. But, you know, one thing is I'm going to point to Janice down in Houston. She works with doctors who create medical devices. It's hard to do. This is so impressive. And I had never thought until the moment Arthur said it that the world is built to sell reusable, disposable medical devices. They do not want permanent medical devices. It's just echoing in my head. That's a big story button push right there. So you're our person of the day. Good job.
Yay.
That gets you an apple. You just have to purchase it yourself and wash it really good before you eat it. Yes.
And our question that we ask every, I don't know if we told them how this show's going to end. Boy, you're in for a surprise. Here's a question. It is, what goes in your backpack? And, you know, I know Arthur already knows one thing that's going in there, but we ask you for anything, either one thing, physical or metaphorical. So it could be anything from a harmonica to go with your life back, or it could be something metaphorical like the ability to dream. So, Carrie, what is a great physical item someone's put in their backpack before?
Extra set of teeth. It's always going to be my favorite. DJ Cumberbund.
Totally want to know the story on that one.
DJ Cumberbund is a mashup, like remix artist on YouTube, and he's a freelance butcher on the side. And I don't know if he ever explained why he needed it.
Well, because he's a big, huge fan of professional wrestling, and most especially Macho Man Randy Savage. And a lot of those guys have had some dental stories happen, and an extra set of teeth might be actually a very handy thing. Carrie, what's a good metaphorical thing someone could add to a backpack?
Kindness.
Oh, kindness is such a good one.
Yeah. That's a good one.
I'll never get old. Yeah. All right. Arthur Lee, what is something you should put in your backpack?
Well, you know, the real thing is my life back, because that's a given for me. But you know what? For today, I'm going to take something Karen said, and the thought of when you're making a presentation, that to think of the story, your audience, and what you're trying to grasp. Like, to dumb down all the statistics and the whatnot to make a story that they will listen to. So for today, that's my life back and Karen's advice.
I love it. That's beautiful.
Wow. You are a very caring and thoughtful guy, Arthur. Oh. I think Lily is very lucky.
Yeah, except she zapped me out of the thing.
Stop with that.
Interesting.
Here.
She's like, okay, bye.
What do I tell my daughter? She'll love it.
So you got to get caught up on SNL, so you need to get off the internet.
Got to get off this thing. Hey, Karen Ebert, we need to know from you. What is something we could put in the backpack?
Before I do that, two things, Arthur, you need to always talk about how you always are bringing your life back with you because you can't be the inventor and never have it with you. That was really powerful. And I think what Chris said is also really powerful of we invent medical devices to expire. Like those are two important parts of your story as you go forward for what it's worth. For me, I'm going to stay on theme. It's going to be a book. Like when I was a child, my mom taught me to read around age 4. And I read so much that I walked into a wall reading a book as a child. So if I don't have something to read, I'm going to go mad. So it would be a book, preferably an electronic book so I could have an unlimited supply.
I used to tune out my teachers at school. I'd be reading and I'd put my fingers in my ears because all the classroom's really loud. And then like I'd look up and the whole class would be out for recess or something. Still be reading.
One of our other backpack guests, Whiskey Nate. Whiskey Nate had a kind of rough go of his young businessman life. He wasn't really fitting into many places. And recently the way he makes his money is he climbs mountains with a bottle of whiskey in his backpack. And he shows off the bottle of whiskey at the top of the mountain.
Like on top of a rock or something with a vista behind it.
Sometimes
whiskey
a dog.
With a view.
Sometimes with a couple of pals. And Whiskey Nate is kind of easy on the eyes. And that's how he makes his
ripped.
Life.
Yeah.
He's gorgeous.
But that's a whiskey with a view. You look at the whiskey. Whiskey Nate. You look at Nate.
Yeah. And so what Nate added to the backpack was a book you hate. Because in his mind, not just a book, but a book that you maybe had to wrestle with to see if you could get something out of it. Thought that was crazy.
If it's the only book you have, you'll read it eventually and really work to get something out of it.
My grandmother would have appreciated this show because she was somehow always there when my brother or I were choking on something. And she was like a karate black belt trying to help us get that food out of us to the point that I wonder sometimes if she was also maybe trying to get out some of her anger.
Hi, everyone. Tim Kitzer from NBA.
Oh, that's not the ending of the show. That's the beginning of the show. Wait,
you have just one job on the show.
You want to hear the beginning of our other show?